Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. About 30 years ago, in 1988, I had my tenth rains as a bhikkhu. I spent in the forest at Chithurst. We only had one kuti, one hut in the forest in those days. We took it in turns to use it. And during that time, without really having intended to, I ended up writing poems for much of the, not all day, every day, but for much of the retreat there. And one of the little poems that I wrote at that time came to mind the other day when I was visiting Stephen Suslov, the former Ajahn Santajito, who's very close to the end of his life. And if I remember the words correctly, and it was written with respect to the fact that the retreat in the forest was coming to its end, just another few days left of the retreat. So the verse was written with respect to the 90 days of retreat coming to a close. And so the poem just went, a river runs its final race to merge with Father Sea, surrenders to its end without complaint. An excursion of existence, another little life, has run its course at last and now returns. So that came to mind when I was visiting our dear friend Steve Santajito a couple of days ago. He was, as I was mentioning, at the community breakfast, and other times he was a monk in this community from the early 70s, one of the first Westerners to come and join with Venerable Ajahn Chah in Thailand, and found his way there in about, I think, 71, 72, around about then, and became a monk under Ajahn Chah's guidance and lived in Thailand there for about 12, 13 years. And then when Amaravati opened in 1984, 85, then he came here and joined the foundational community here at Amaravati. After a number of years here, Lumpur Sumedho invited him to take over as the abbot of the monastery in Devon, which he did. But then after a number of years, more than 20 years in the robes, and he decided to return to lay life, and then continued as a lay practitioner. As a child, he was a child prodigy mathematician. He grew up in New York City and was a brilliant student, brilliant mathematician. But when he joined the Sangha, he put very definitely put his whole academic career and that aspect of his brilliance behind him, and put his attention onto spiritual training. And after he left the monastic life, he definitely didn't go into the academic world, but rather he took up life as in a very humble hospital orderly, nursing assistant roles in Chichester, in southern England, south of where Chithurst Monastery is, in the small cathedral town of Chichester, and lived there until this present day. So this last, 15 years or so. So we're now at 2018, so for about 15, 20 years he's lived there in Chichester. And a few months ago he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and that's now spread to such a degree that it's untreatable, and he's been given about 2 weeks left to live in all likelihood. So I mentioned this morning and shared with residents here at the community breakfast today, I was very glad to be able to go and visit him and to have a couple of hours in his company and to talk with him and to also hear his own perspective on the ending of his life. And I was very, very touched. He's been a good friend, a very diligent student for the time I've been back here in England over the last 8 years. He's come on many retreats with me, usually a couple every year. So he's probably done about a dozen, 12 or 15 retreats with me in the last 8 years. So I've seen a lot of him. And it's been very lovely to have that sort of exchange of roles where I was a junior person entering the community and he was one of the elders. And I've sort of switched seats with him and become in the teaching role, and he's been in the student role. But in many respects, we shared a life as Kalyanamita, as spiritual friends. And that even though I'm the monk now, he's the layperson, then still we're all sahadamikas, you can say, spiritual companions, fellow Dhamma farers. In his attitude, I was particularly impressed by the sense of kind of interest in him, that this was a quote-unquote unique opportunity for practice, seeing your own life winding up, your control over the body and its mobility and its range of activities being kind of greatly reduced, and the sense of there isn't any more time, that there isn't going to be a next year, there isn't even going to be a next month in all likelihood. Reflecting on how that affects the way that the world is seen, how the body is seen, how your friendships are seen, how your past is seen, how the future is seen. And I was impressed and touched by the practicality and straightforwardness with which he was relating to the winding up of his life. So that was that little verse that I'd written all those years ago popped into my mind. It's a sense of a river running its final race, when the river forms, the rain falls on the hills and the mountains and then gathers together into small streams and then larger streams and gathers together into the large rivers, and then the rivers flow to the sea, and then the water that was comprising the river then reaches the sea, and the river water merges with the sea. The river ends; it comes to its end. But just as the water running in a river flows naturally downhill and reaches the sea without complaint, a river runs its final race to merge with Father Sea, surrenders to its end without complaint. The water that's in the river has come from the sea in the first place, as they reckon by our understanding of weather and the way that the rain and the sea, wind and moisture functions in nature. That it's the evaporation of water from the sea forms into rain clouds and falls on the land, and that's where our rains come from in a large part. So that it's returning home. There's a certain sense of a cycle being completed, an excursion of existence. The rain, the water has risen up from the sea, evaporated into the sky, gathered together as raindrops, fallen on the land, and then flowed back again to the sea. There's an excursion of existence. So that's also what, in talking with Steve, and also in our own standard classical reflections that we've received from the Buddha's teachings and our ajahns over the years, this is the wise way to reflect upon our life. That these elements that form our body, they first came together at our conception, our birth. They are integrated with all of the the food we eat, the water we drink, the air we breathe, they're nurtured, they grow up, they develop, the elements are continually brought into the body and fall away from the body, and the body integrates, grows up from infancy, childhood, adolescence, adulthood, middle age, old age, and then the integration process breaks down, and the disintegration process takes over, and those elements that were integrated together in the form of a human life, then they fall apart. That integration stops, and disintegration takes over, and we call that the ending of a life. We call that physical death, our life coming to an end, passing away. But the elements that make up our lives, you know, how many of us, you know, consider that the body that we had as a baby is totally different from the body that we have now, even though there might be a few scars or bits missing that we've received along the way that still persist. The elements that make up our body from our conception and our early childhood to now, those elements have changed. They've come together and fallen apart many, many times over the years. It's a continual integrative and disintegrative process. Things come together, they fall apart. Whatever is subject to arising is subject to ceasing. And the ending of a life is really where that, we can see, looking very very directly, that the forces that support the integration, things coming together and working and forming into the organs and the functions, the life force of the body, they lose their functionality, their integration breaks up. They don't work together so well. They don't function together so easily. That which is holding it all together, loses its strength, loses its power, and then the natural ending, the breaking apart, the disintegration, the vayadhamma, the natural process of collapse and disintegration, and takes over. So that if we have a skillful attitude, then we don't think of this as anything going wrong, like. We don't think of a river flowing to the sea as something going wrong. It says, well, of course, water falls on the ground in the form of rain. Streams form into rivers. Rivers flow to the sea, and then the river ends, and the sea is replenished. It's nothing wrong or disastrous or bad about that. We in fact can rejoice that, delight in that that quality. It's something that is sort of beautiful, natural, inspiring. But when it comes to our life, you know, running its race to merge with the sea and the elements that make up our life, this particular river coming to its end, then it's a whole different story, a whole different attitude. It's like, oh, this is a disaster. The Thames is ending. As soon as it reaches the Essex coast and the Kent coast, it's not the Thames anymore. Oh no, disaster. It's kind of crazy, isn't it? We don't think of the river entering the sea as a disaster or a problem or even as a loss. It's just a natural change. But when we are identified with our body, our personality, our personal story, our possessions, our relationships, our friendships, our hatreds, then this life, who I am, the degree to which the mind is identified with that, then death feels like a disaster, like a loss, like something that is to be prevented and avoided at all costs. So the Buddha was not, he didn't teach in a way of promoting any kind of a death cult. You know, certainly the way of the Buddha was to look after the body, to look after the material world, to look after each other to the degree possible. We sustain the forms of our life, our family, our friends, our companions. We do the best we can to help these particular rivers function well and to be in a good state of health. But there's a recognition that they're like a river, only goes in one direction. Because on the canoeing on the Barrow River in Ireland with Paddy Boyle a couple of weeks ago, and we were reflecting together on the delightful nature of canoeing, and say traveling on the waterways of Ireland. And one comment that I made was, yeah, well, one thing about traveling on a river is that you can never go in the wrong direction because the water only flows downhill. So if you can tell which direction the water's flowing, you know, okay, it's that way. But that's the way we're going. You, like on a road or a footpath, you can easily lose your way, head in the wrong direction. But a river only flows one way. There's absolutely a guarantee that the water will not flow uphill. That just doesn't happen. So that inevitability, if we look at our life, that we see avaya dhamma sankhara, that all formations, all things that have come together, are of the nature to fall apart. That's the very last instruction of the Buddha before his parinibbana, before his final passing away, was avaya dhamma sankhara appamadena sampadeta. Avaya dhamma sankhara, the nature of everything that is compounded, sankhara, anything that has come together, anything that has been formed, is that it will break apart. That which has integrated will disintegrate. That's its nature. That's the nature of all things. If it's a thought, if it's an emotion, if it's a memory, if it's a physical form of your body, if it's a chair, if it's a microphone, if it's a building, if it's a monastery, whatever has come together, physical or mental, coarse or fine, pure or impure, personal or impersonal, if something has formed, then that thingness is going to come to an end. That's a natural process. That there's a integration and disintegration go together. You can't have the one without the other. Nature simply does not work that way. And so then, just as we don't feel heartbreak or a sense of loss or a feeling of wrongness or it shouldn't be this way or this isn't fair, when a river flows to the sea and the water of the river merges with the sea, then if we're wise, then we'll relate to our life in exactly this way. We'll look upon these faculties that we have, our ability to talk, our ability to think, our ability to move, to hear, to see, to remember, all these say faculties, these abilities that we have as human beings. Maybe some of us don't hear so well, we don't see so well, maybe we have limbs that are missing, or we have injuries, we have dependencies, like maybe we're diabetic, or we have a chronic infection, or different hindrances or physical losses already, and we can perhaps relate to them as with an attitude of resentment or negativity. If only my hearing was better. If only my eyesight was better. If only I didn't. If only I wasn't diabetic, or if only I wasn't a man, or wasn't a woman, or wasn't this age. If only I was younger. If only I was older. If only I wasn't. If I didn't have this particular issue, then everything would be fine. But the Buddha's teaching and our practice points their mind in a very different direction. If we really contemplate the way that the world works, the way that nature functions, we will see that the faculties that we have, the ability to see, the ability to think, to hear, to smell, to taste, to touch, to move, to remember, to interact, the ability to bond with other people, to separate from other people, all of those capacities that we have, they are all dependent. They're all part of a natural order. They're not who and what we are. They're not under personal control. They are anatta. And when we look directly, we see, well, rather than feeling disappointed or upset when our hearing goes or our eyesight goes, or we can't remember the name of that monk who we're sitting next to, and we know we've known him for 15 years, but suddenly his name is gone. Begins with an S, I think. One time when Lumpo Samato was leading he was giving a talk at a conference and leading a meditation for a weekend. One of the monks that was with him who he'd known for a decade, he completely forgot his name. He could remember the name he had as a novice, but when he became a bhikkhu, his name had changed. And even though he was some, there was only, at that time, there was only like 12 of us in the community. So it was a very small community, early days of Chithurst. And Lumpur had gone on this this seminar, sort of retreat, taking this monk with him. And he was just amazed. I can't remember his name. I know him so well. What's his name? And it was gone. It was completely gone. He said, I'm not even 60 yet, and my memory's going. And he, no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't remember this monk's name. He had his novice name, but he couldn't remember his bhikkhu name. So he was, of course, at those kind of events, you're having to, you're chatting with people and introducing yourself. Oh, this monk is an old friend of mine. He's from my monastery in West Sussex. You find yourself dodging around the fact you can't remember this person's name. And so if we're foolish, then we fear that, we resent that. Oh dear, it's an embarrassment. What will they think if I've forgotten their name? But if we're wise, we'll recognize, well, it's really great that I can remember all these monks' names. Ajahn Aryasila, Ajahn Varado, Ajahn Brahmavara, Sister Jayati. This is great. Tanidaro, Niraso. How nice, I can remember. But if we're wise, we'll think, well, that's a temporary condition because their names will all go and my name will probably go. I've got a few names, but there'll come a time when the mind doesn't remember all of that, forgets what Amaravati is. And when even hearing those words, if I say there's gonna come a time when my mind won't remember my own name, won't remember what Amaravati is, then something in us says, "Oh, don't say that. That's ridiculous. How could that be? I mean, you're the abbot. You're in charge. You can't ever forget this place." But sabbe sankhara anicca, all sankhara is impermanent. Vayadama sankhara, all conditioned things, all compounded things are subject to becoming uncompounded, disintegrating. Everything that has integrated will disintegrate. So if we're wise and we follow the Buddha's advice, we will prepare ourselves that we recognize, oh, how nice that I can hear. Great, that's not going to last forever. And then when the hearing goes, then rather than thinking, oh, it's a disaster, this isn't fair, why me, this is so awful, instead we'll think, there it goes. I was enjoying that, but never mind. There it goes. That particular river has merged with the sea. I can't hear anymore. Can't see anymore. My grandfather went blind between when he was 70 and 75. My mother went blind between when she was 70 and 75. I'm now 61, heading towards 62 in a few weeks' time. So, and I take after my mother's father, and very much I look just like him, according to my family. And I take after my mother very closely. So I'm looking forward to the likelihood that my eyesight will start to seriously go in a few years' time. I don't like the idea. I prepare for that possibility. Macular degeneration is not enjoyable, but that's in the genes. So if I'm wise, I'll get ready for it and meet it when it comes, rather than, oh no, this is awful, I can't let this happen. But I can consciously, at the present time, recognize, well, this is great. I can, how delightful to be able to see people. Yeah, you're a bit blurry. I haven't got my glasses on, but I can still see. Great. How delightful that this faculty is here at the moment. But it's vayadama sankhara. It's in a state of disintegration. Just being able to enjoy the colors of the living world, the experiential world. This morning it was such a bright, clear day. Coming out of the sala, looking at the beautiful blue sky and the green of the leaves in the morning sunlight against the bright sky. Ooh, delightful! But then, if there's wisdom, you recognize, well, at this moment, this is delightful. This won't be here forever. Now, this might seem really gloomy or really depressing. But if we are, again, if there's wisdom, then looking at that sort of, oh, don't say that, that's really awful, you're making me really upset. That if there is that kind of flurried, fluttering, fretful feeling, don't say that, oh, this is really awful, or that's not fair, why me, don't say that, you'll make it happen. It's helpful to look at that feeling and to explore that. Well, what is it that's intimidated? What is it that's challenged or afraid of that possibility? What is it that feels like it's got the right to see clearly all the time, or to be mobile, to be able to walk around, to move? What is it that assumes that and takes that as who we are and ours? And if that's looked at, if that's really explored, there's a recognition that that's very much the habit of self-view, the I, me, mine feeling, the I making, mine making habits of mind, the ahankara, mamankara. It's the I can see, I can think, I can feel, I can move. I am this person. This is my name. These are my friends. This is what I do. This is my job. This is my place, these are my things. That which takes those I's and me's and mine's for granted, that is the kind of the habit of self-view, the attitude of self-view. This is me, this is what I am, these are my things. That which believes that to be absolutely true, that is sakkaya ditti, self-view, as we say in Buddhist psychology. So if the mind looks past that, or lets go of those habits of self-view, then underneath that, or behind that, that habit of self-view, that way of seeing, there's this wisdom of the heart, the citta, the faculty of the citta itself, the eye of Dhamma, if you like, which recognizes, well, of course, duh, of course it's not yours, of course it's impermanent. How could it be permanent? How could that be something that is owned? It's all in a state of incessant change. Of course, there's no owner, there's no person who's in charge or who's the controller. There never has been. It's always been a fabricated, compounded, formed experience that nothing has changed, nothing has gone wrong. It's always been this way. And so then when the heart meets with that experience or that recognition of change, of transiency, of things being in a state of transformation, constant mutation and change, then the experience of the heart is that of relief or delight. Of course, it's always been this way, you know. So the ego, the self-view, is threatened, but the heart rejoices. Of course, everything's impermanent. How could it be otherwise? Ah, it's that way. So underneath that flurrying, fluttering, fretful attitude, if there's a close looking, then there's something in the heart that goes, ah, of course, vaya dhamma sankara, everything's changing, everything is impermanent. No thing is reliable. Because the feeling of relief is then no longer looking at our brain or our eyes or our objects to be something that are refuge or are what we are looking to be dependable or secure or a place of safety. But rather, it's that quality of awareness, that quality of wise, wakeful knowing, that is the refuge. That's what we realize is what is dependable. So, talking with Steve a couple of days ago, it was really, really touching that even as his mobility is very, very compromised, he can only move about very, very slowly, very, very, very cautiously, and he has a lot of physical pain. He was saying that one of the things that's striking, even though he realized he's very happy to acknowledge that he has not reached full and complete enlightenment, that he didn't so quote unquote, finish his work in terms of the Buddha's path during this lifetime. But also along the way, there were some indelible changes. The impact of being close to Lumpur Cha, being in the presence and drawing so near, being so close to such a wise being, that presence of that extraordinary wisdom and freedom had an indelible effect. There's a radical change of heart that meant that regardless of what he's experiencing or feeling in terms of emotion or sensation or thought, there's an indelible and unshakable quality of perspective, an attitude of understanding, a recognition, in a way, an ease of heart. And that's the most precious thing, that sense of that attitude of, as the body winds up and the faculties fall apart, things break down, that attitude of the heart is, nothing is going wrong. It's just an old vehicle that's on its way to the scrapyard. That's all. You know, this vehicle is no longer repairable. It's the parts need to be recycled. That's the way things are. Nothing's gone wrong. It's not pleasant. You're not pretending that the painful is delightful or pleasant. But here it is. It's the river running to merge with the sea. That's all. It's reaching, the vehicle is reaching the end of its viability. A1. Thus it is. So that that was really lovely to see, beautiful to see. There was this, and that he could also recognize that there was this sense of unshakable conviction or certainty, kind of unquestionable clarity in attitude, which is, I would say, is the most precious, most helpful thing, that is there, that's present and can be the means through which all of the changes, the ups and downs of emotion and feeling and perception that occur in the whole dying process, that essential wisdom that, you know, nothing's going wrong. This is just the experience of a life ending. That's all. And when there is that attitude, the heart takes refuge in that attitude, seeing things with the eye of Dhamma is how, you know, one can put it. Then the ending of a life doesn't bring with it a sense of loss. Just like if we're wise, as our memory goes, and you can't remember where you are in the chanting, and you're supposed to be leading it. What's that next word? How does that next verse begin? It's gone. Rather than feeling that as a disaster or a loss or something to be embarrassed about, then one recognizes, oh, well, it was, I used to be able to remember. Now it's beginning to fall apart, or it has fallen apart. Okay. Maybe it'll come back together again. Maybe not. But in this moment, it's this way. So the heart does not relate to it as a loss, but rather it's a demonstration of nature taking its natural course. This is how things are. We do our best moment to moment with what is present, what is available to us. But in the natural process of things, there is a diminishing of personal control as the bodies get older, as sickness and aging has more and more strength, as the forces of disintegration overtake the forces of integration, which can be when we're very young. You know, if we have a serious illness or an injury or some difficulty arises, that disintegration can happen at very, very young age, you know, right from birth or before. So it doesn't depend on the aging process, but with the aging process, that is an inescapable part of it. Then, if there is that attitude of recognizing this is the way nature works, nothing has gone wrong, then we make use of the faculties that we have, and as they wrap up and fall away, then the heart is not diminished. There is no sense of imprisonment in a form, but rather there is the refuge is in that awareness that is knowing the form. It's knowing the body and its feelings and its abilities, and rather than being kind of say trapped in a body that's immobile or non-functional, the heart recognizes it's not trapped. It never was trapped. The heart, which knows the body that is falling apart, is not falling apart. That quality of awareness, that quality of wisdom, is not limited. Is not bound by the confines of the body or our faculties. I've often mentioned a meeting I had many years ago. Ajahn Sujito and I were in Cambridge. Ajahn Sujito was running a weekend of teachings, and I was along with him as a second monk. And we were invited to visit this man called John Nightingale, who was in Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge. And one of the people in the Buddhist group had been a work partner with him. They'd had some business ventures together in the building world. The fellow John Nightingale had been had a building company and had been a very sort of dynamic, active fellow. And when Ajahn Sujito and I met him, he'd come down with motor neurone disease, and so when we met him, he could no longer move or speak from the neck down. He communicated. He had a champagne cork with a knitting needle stuck in it, and a letterboard, so he could move his head a little bit, and he could move his knitting needle to spell out words on his letterboard, so he could communicate. But 95% of his body was completely paralyzed. But he was one of the happiest people I've ever met. His eyes were amazingly bright and kind of sparkly. And he sort of basically told us his story through his letterboard, and it was a really powerful meeting, a powerful encounter, because you'd think someone who has been very active, he was a paratrooper in the army, he was a very vigorous and active, competent person, very busy with his building company and so forth after he'd left the army. And you think, oh, he must be really depressing, or a disaster must be so awful for him to be so paralyzed, and your death is just a few weeks away. But he was extraordinarily bright and clear in his whole manner. And through his letterboard, he told us how, yeah, when he first got diagnosed, he was just angry with the doctors, with everybody, with everything, with life. And then, after a time, I got tired of being angry and just couldn't keep that going anymore, and it wasn't really helping. So, I remembered that this friend David, who he'd done building work with, he said, I remember that David used to meditate, and I used to tease him about it and make fun of him, sitting watching his navel. But I thought maybe, since I'm stuck in this chair and I can't move and can't do anything, maybe to learn some meditation would be a useful thing. So then this friend of his, David, had given him some meditation instruction, and then also just talked about Buddhist principles and the Buddha's encouragement with respect to illness and aging and death. And he found that extraordinarily helpful. Obviously, the fact of his paralysis and his encroaching disease, it was just, his body was just getting more and more numb and immobile from the hands and the feet to upwards. And so by the time we met, as I said, he couldn't speak anymore, but he could move his pointer on the letterboard. And then he said, and said where it's come to now, he said, I feel sorry for these people. And he pointed his knitting needle around the hospital ward. And he said, yeah, look at them, you know, the doctors, the nurses, they mean well, but they're just so full of themselves. They're just so busy with what they think is important. He says, is, you know, it's, I don't know whether to laugh or cry. Yeah, that if only they understood what they're in the middle of, they wouldn't be so wrapped up in their kind of flirting with each other or trying to be the important doctor who's kind of in charge of everything. And he said, you know, I just, he said, I don't know whether to laugh or cry. I just, I feel it's kind of hilarious what they're all caught up in, but also really sad that they can't see that they're surrounded by these messages. You know, the people they're looking after. You know, we're all in bed. You know, we're stuck here. Some of us are totally paralyzed, not going to live long, and their doctors and nurses, this is their field, their knowledge, but they don't realize it applies to them too. They're in the same boat, and somehow they don't get it. He says, I don't know whether to laugh or cry. And he wasn't being kind of sort of conceited or looking down on them, but he was very sincere. Also, you know, talking with a knitting needle, you can't talk very quickly. So he was sort of spelling this out slowly. But it was really touching to see the quality of wisdom that he had developed through the illness. And he only had a few weeks left to live. He died, I think, about 6 weeks later. He couldn't swallow anymore and got infections in his lungs and died of pneumonia, I think, about 6 weeks later. But he really was one of the happiest people I've ever met. Also, one of the most free people I'd ever met, even though he was paralyzed, couldn't speak. There was this extraordinary freedom. So I'm not recommending that we paralyze ourselves or seek out ways of getting motor neurone disease or breaking our necks. That's not the path the Buddha recommended. You're not trying to injure ourselves, but the keeping the precepts, living simply, changing our attitude towards our relationships, our work life, our possessions, our body. You know, this is what the Buddha's teaching does recommend, that we shift our view and we reflect on this body, our health, our possessions, our relationships, our way of life. Look at it. You know, to what degree are we caught up in those games? To what degree are we missing the fact that these bodies are time bombs? That these are all streams heading towards the great ocean. They're heading in one direction only. You know, water only flows one way, downhill. So the recollections that the Buddha gave, what are called the five subjects for frequent recollection, the Abhinna Pachavekana. He encouraged, whether you're a layperson or a monastic, you know, as a human being, he recommended, you know, to every day bring these aspects of life to mind. You know, I am of the nature to age. I am of I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken. I've not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I've not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise. Will become separated from me. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So to the ego, again, these are really depressing. You know, I'm of the nature to age, I'm of the nature to sicken, I'm of the nature to die. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. So part of us will think, well, thanks, Arjan, you know. This is a Saturday night. I've come here to get depressed, have I? You know, you're kind of, was the Buddha a sadist? You know, was he sort of enjoying a good laugh at all us poor, miserable rats trapped in our mazes? But it's not the case, because we reflect upon aging to recognize and ailing and sickness and death. To recognize that which is unaging, unailing, that which is deathless. But by running away from it, then we empower it. By turning towards it and acknowledging it, then we are able to free, or to realize, to embody that quality of us which is unborn, undying, which is unaging, unailing, which is deathless. That's the mysterious way that it works. that by reflecting, I am of the nature to age, I am of the nature to sicken, I am of the nature to die, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, and so on. That by stating those words in a mysterious way, in an ironic, strange way, it helps the heart to awaken to that insight that, well, that's not the whole story. Yes, this body is of the nature to age and to sicken and to die, but the body is not self. Oh, all that is mine. Well, it's not really mine. When we say something is mine, like these are my robes, or this is, you know, my seat, or this is my monastery. Yeah, that mineness, that can only ever be relative. It's not absolutely true or real. I mean, it's just a way of speaking. And our heart recognizes that no thing can ever really be owned, and there's no thing to really do any owning. It's just a way of speaking. Say, you know, these are my robes, and when they finally fall apart, they won't be my robes anymore. we use that sense, the language, as a means of expression, but it's not the whole story. So, when we bring that to mind, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. It awakens that insight, that wisdom of the heart that recognizes, well, that mine feeling, that's not really solid or true or real, will become separated from me. Well, there, yeah, of course, everything is in a constant state of change and motion. How could that not be the case? And what's this me that would be the owner, that is the thing that was trying to possess anything? There's no thing really there. Aha! So by bringing the attention to those perceptions based on ego, on self-view, on habit, then it illuminates them. It kind of reveals their limited nature. It kind of turns the lights up so you can see all the details, and you realize, oh, that was just a mistaken view, a partial view. That wasn't the whole story. How could it have been the whole story? So rather than those reflections being a source of depression or a source of an attack or a cause of anxiety, instead, they if they're used wisely, then they bring about the exact opposite effect. They free the heart from anxiety. They free the heart from threat, from fear, because it helps that the heart to awaken to its own nature, which is unborn, undying, unailing, unaging, deathless. Or maybe the last thing to share this evening was respect to this area of contemplation. In the few retreats that I've led here at Amaravati, on death and dying, or on the heavenly messengers, of aging, sickness, death, and renunciation. Then I had the death rehearsal meditations that we've held here in the temple on these retreats a couple of times, two or three times. And this is a kind of meditation where you are invited to imagine that when you sit down, actually, it's a lying down meditation. So everyone would lie down. So you have women on one half of the temple, men on the other half of the temple, and put a couple of mats together and make it sort of separate little lying spots, death beds for everybody. And the meditation works by inviting everyone to consider, this is the last half an hour or 45 minutes of one's life. So when the bell goes, that is your last moment. And so that so it's a guided meditation over what you're using your imagination to explore as the last few minutes of your life. And so it's a guided meditation all the way through. And along the way, then I would invite people to particularly contemplate different areas of their experience. So if you've only got half an hour or 45 minutes left of your life, that to consider, first of all, what are you still carrying around as a resentment, that unforgiven quality of your parents or your ex-partners or your Ajahn who let you down or the NHS, whatever it might be, that the way you're still carrying a resentment and a grudge around in your heart. There's that in your heart which doesn't want to forgive, which is carrying around. To look at what resentments that you still have towards any others, and to guide the heart towards forgiveness. Then to look at your own actions and to see if there's anything that you regret, things that you feel that you could have done that you never did, that was a sort of unrequited, that unfulfilled, or things that you did that were hurtful to others or that were caused a negative or destructive effect. So to look at those and to forgive yourself for those shortcomings or those actions that were harmful, or things that the great novel that you never wrote, or the foolish choice that you made that caused someone to be injured or to cause emotional harm to others. So to look at your own regrets and to forgive yourself. And then the third aspect would be to cultivate gratitude, what you're grateful for, and that all of the many gifts that you receive from your parents or your teachers, and what you feel grateful for. And so the first couple of times I did this this guided meditation, this death rehearsal, those were the three areas that I focused on. And then the last time I did it, I realized there was something missing. And maybe it was significant that I'd forgotten this or didn't really bring it in. But I realized, well, actually, there is a fourth one. Not just being grateful for what others have given you, your teachers and your parents and your loved ones, all you've received from others, but the things that you have done that you feel pleased about. That what the Buddha called chaganusati, to recollect your own goodness, to look at those things in your life that you say, yeah, I'm really glad I did that. That was really worthwhile. And in the West, we tend to shy away from any kind of positive thought about any of our actions. We tend to think of it as being conceited or arrogant or being proud or inflated. But the Buddha did encourage this practice of chaganusati, to recollect your own goodness as a way of acknowledging that there's blessings have been brought into the world because of your actions. Things that you have done did bring good results. They brought benefit for yourself and others. That's not to be ignored. It's like a recognition of your own brightness, your own goodness, not from a place of ego or inflation, but from a place recognition that even if it wasn't you that had done it, it's good to recognize those actions, those words, those things were of benefit. They brought blessing into the world. So I would say that's the fourth thing to bring to mind, and is to look at your own goodness, to acknowledge, well, if somebody else had done that, I would praise them and say, yeah, well done, that's great. Because I did it, I kind of, well, it wasn't really anything. I was just sort of doing what I should have done. It was part of what was the right thing to do. And yeah, I shouldn't feel that good about it. It was just what should have been done. So we can shy away from it. But I feel in cultivating a skillful attitude, skillful practices in relationship to this area of our lives and the fragility of our life, and when we're getting close to the ending of our life, which of course can be any moment, that this is also something to bring to mind, to be consciously aware of the goodness of our own actions. So these are a few reflections, inspired by our good friend Stephen Saslav, Santajito, and as his river. As that river runs to its final race to merge with the sea, that how wonderful that there are beings who can, say, skillfully relate to their life as they live it and as it comes to an end, and also what gifts that brings to the rest of us to have a good example, and also to be able to rejoice in the fact that of his own, say, peacefulness and the goodness that he has brought into the world, and what that say offers for us as his friends and as say recipients of his wise understanding, his wise approach, and his good life. Ewan.